1-2. Is it, are we okay now?
Yeah.
Yours down there, Vern? Okay. And,
found in the major known oil fields just discussed also exist in the coastal plain, in
and indications are that all the geologic ingredients favorable for large deposits of oil and gas do exist. Those ingredients include source rocks that generate hydrocarbons, thick layers of reservoir rock to accumulate oil and gas, and large structures to trap the oil and gas, and favorable geologic history. In addition to the many years of surface geologic work carried out in the coastal plain, more recently under ANILCA and strict government regulation, seismic surveys were conducted to help verify the existence of favorable subsurface and structural features. The next step in the exploration process is to drill test wells to confirm what we hope to be significant reserves, which can offset declining North Slope production in the coming years. The actual presence of recoverable reserves can only be verified by drilling these promising structures. The report estimates a 19% chance of finding economically recoverable oil on the coastal plain. This promising outlook for success helps explain industry's high interest in exploring the coastal plain because it represents a tenfold increase over the statistical industry success rate in Alaska. Historically, only 1 out of 50, or 2% of the exploratory wells drilled in Alaska has ever resulted in a commercial discovery. Our industry has demonstrated its compatibility to explore for, develop, and produce oil in the Alaska Arctic without significant adverse impact on wildlife and the environment. The dire predictions of environmental degradation and harm to wildlife made 15 years ago, prior to the development of the giant Prudhoe Bay field and the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, have proven to be unfounded. The predicted demise of major caribou herds, deterioration in water quality, and major losses of habitat simply have not occurred. Instead, the development of Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline have permitted the production of over 5 billion barrels of much-needed oil with minimal environmental impact. During the 15-year period of development, wildlife has thrived in the midst of oil field development, as evidenced by the fact that the Central Arctic caribou herd has grown from about 3,000 to a population now estimated at over 13,000 animals. Economic benefits for future North Slope development to the state and nation are extremely significant. Direct benefits to the state and federal governments include bonus payments, rentals, royalties, and taxes. Oil development on the North Slope has provided hundreds of billions of dollars to the Alaska and U.S. economy. Therefore, petroleum development from the coastal plain, especially on the order of magnitude of Kuparuk or Prudhoe Bay, would promote significant economic development not only within Alaska, but also throughout the United States. In closing, I'd like to emphasize again that the Alaska Oil and Gas Association strongly supports this committee's resolution on opening the Anwar Coastal Plain to greatly needed oil and gas exploration and production. Thank you for this opportunity to address the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sturgill.
A short question. Yesterday we heard testimony from the federal government and the state regarding their assessment, and I wonder if AOGA has done an evaluation of, I noticed you quote from the report as to recoverable reserves and so on. Have you done independent analysis on those figures?
No, AOGA has not done any analysis.
Thank you, sir.
For the record, AOGA has created a chart or a map that reflects the number of dollars that has been spent in the economy and the other lower 48 as to the what has been generated on the slope. Is that correct?
Yes.
Would you make that chart or that map available to the committee?
Sure will. I'll have copies for you next weekend when you're in Anchorage.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Jones? Thank you very much, Wayne, for your presentation. If you have it written, why, if you could submit it. If not, why, we'll take it off of the tape. We have next Dr. Rosenau from the University of Alaska. Is that wrong? Is the University of Alaska, is it?
No. Also, I'm not a doctor. I'm with LGL. My name is Dave Rosenau.
Okay, Dave.
I'm with LGL, Alaska Research Associates, currently a research biologist with them. I live here in Fairbanks, and I've been asked to come here and comment on variation in calving of the porcupine herd, primarily because of my familiarity with the herd stemming from the Arctic gas days. Early and mid-70s. I conducted fairly intensive surveys of that herd during that period from 72 to 77, and quite familiar with the herd. up make a few comments on caribou in general. And before I do that, one thing that we don't have here is a map from the 1002 report. You may have it there in your copies of the report, but it's right. There's a map in there that is pink that shows the cavagram.
Lake 2A. Lake 2A?
Right, correct.
Lake 2.
A few general comments about caribou first. They're very social, gregarious beasts. Basically migrate year-round, undertaking an annual life cycle that's basically characterized by strong, forceful movements during part of the year that include spring migration, post-calving migrations, fall migration, and some early winter movements. And these are interspersed with weaker, less directed movements, essentially pauses, times of calving, coalescing into calving, post-calving aggregations, late summer dispersal, and wintering. And basically, the animals are constantly on the move. The reason I mention this, I think a lot of people are familiar with the fact that caribou migrate basically north, in many cases in the spring, and south in the fall, but really they're migrating for all practical purposes 12 months out of the year. With brief pauses in there. And this annual pattern of movement is basically traditional for each of the herds, but it tends to vary considerably from year to year. In other words, spring migration, in one year a certain contingent of animals may follow one route, more may follow another route the other year, and it varies quite a bit over the long term, but the basic pattern is there. The calving grounds are basically part, of course, of that annual cycle, and they also are traditional in the sense that the animals go there every year to have their calves. And the calving grounds of the porcupine herd, here's the projection that will help a little bit. The calving grounds of the porcupine herd isn't completely shown on this map. Basically, the eastern boundary is, it's about 200 miles long, extending from the Babbage River in the Yukon over to the Canning River, basically in Alaska. And it varies roughly from about 25 to 50 miles deep, depending on where you are in there. And that's the area that's considered to be
Dave, are these charts, are the charts that we have here we're going to follow?
I'm going to show a few of those, just not all of them, but to give you some idea of some of the variation.
So in your study, there's two basic concentrated calving areas.
What? No. It's much more complex than that. So the calving grounds is large and it's traditional. And basically, a comment on calving grounds. This calving grounds has a couple of traits that you might say are universal to other calving grounds. Two of the most important features of calving grounds appear to be that they're relatively predator-free, and they also consist of large open spaces that tend to contain minimal concealing cover for predators. In the case of these large northern herds, they're going north of tree line into these areas. Supposedly the calve. And as I said, the calving grounds is traditional in that the animals go there year after year, but really what you might want to think, how you might want to think about it is it's a dynamic tradition. We have this large calving grounds. The animals do go there every year. However, they don't necessarily all go to the same place each year. And there's a lot of variation. They can tend to split up over the years, going to different places. And so it's a fairly dynamic thing. And the bottom line is it really, within that general calving grounds, appears to vary about as much as the other components of the life cycle, like variations in spring migration, fall migration, and so on. And we can run through these. Just to give you a short look at this, just run through some examples. map depicts in 1972, what the boundary of that line depicts is what I consider to be the area in which the majority of animals that year calved. Something in the order of, say, 75% of the cows. What's not shown on this map is that in a somewhat larger area bounding that line would be another line that showed what I call the general calving grounds that year. It's basically defined by the outlier cows. And here now is the area that the majority of those cows ran. Within that area, in a lot of years, we get a tendency for animals to concentrate. In this particular year, we have animals within that area, and we ended up with two general concentrations, what you might call concentrations of animals, although these concentrations are relatively subjective in that if you think of salt and pepper on a table and add a little more pepper to an area as you're flying along, these are areas that both from the size and the general number of animals in there basically stood out to the eye as having a fair number of animals, but they don't necessarily represent much higher densities in other areas. For instance, when you're flying along, you may have a square mile with 300 animals in it, and that would be 300 animals per square mile. That's something that wouldn't be marked down as a concentration like this, where indeed you may go into one of these concentrations, and if you actually took measurements, which we didn't, but the actual densities could be considerably less than that. So in this particular case, about half of the herd calved in Canada this particular year and half in Alaska. And we had about roughly equal-sized concentrations, one in Alaska and one in Canada that year. Let's take a look at the next year. In 1973, we had, and a lot of this variation has to do, I should point out, a number of variables are involved here. Things like the proximity of the wintering animals to the calving ground, the conditions that they encounter, for instance, snow cover as they migrate northward, also whether they get hit by storm fronts as they're migrating. Same holds true once they reach the calving grounds. The conditions snow cover can affect distribution once they hit the calving grounds and whether they get hit by storms and so on. This particular year, snow cover was quite mild, and the animals dispersed all through that area, and indeed we had no concentrations. Again, about half of the animals we estimated were on the Canadian side and about half on the Alaskan side. Take a look at the next year. The next year, just to give you, this gives a real flavor of some real differences. We had the majority of the herd entered Alaska. Almost all of the animals calved in Alaska. They swept much farther west than they had before, and we ended up with a concentration. And in fact, one of the densest concentrations I saw through 72 through 77, there at the western end, fairly close to the Canning River. Let's take a look at the other one, Mark. Another example. Here we're seeing up to 76. Roughly in the order of about two-thirds of the animals in Alaska, a third in Canada, with two concentrations, one of them split between Alaska and Canada. Go ahead.
Look at the next one.
This is a case where this was our first encounter of, again, sort of a similar basic distribution, but here we ended up with five concentrations, several of them quite smaller some of the ones that we've seen in the past, all scattered along.
Dave, when you just ask a question, maybe it's a stupid question, but it's still a question in my mind, is that when you fly along and you're making these counts are made and you're counting, rapidly count, trying to count the caribou in there, are you counting the female that's calved and the calf? I mean, when you're talking about a concentration of so many per square mile, well, you're really counting everything, aren't you? You're counting the bulls, and you're counting the bulls are not
well,
even there, are they?
No, what I should mention is the bulls tend to migrate later. These are the paternal cows, the pregnant cows that hit the grounds first. and the bulls are trailing along, and in fact, it's not till about the time that these animals start leaving Alaska again that the two components of the herd start meeting. Some years we have bulls come into Alaska a little earlier and so on, or into the calving grounds area, I should say.
So when you're counting them, you're counting the calves, and you're counting the females.
These concentrations basically, well, in a sense you're counting the calves, but really what these concentrations were by flying and delineating the boundaries of where the animals were and estimating roughly by often blocks of 1,000 what was in these concentrations. And basically those are cows. And
because when yesterday they were talking about X number of animals per square mile, and I guess the question that I'm wondering is, are we talking about calves that have calved? You mean the cows that have calved, and are we counting both of them when you say so many hundred per square mile? Are we talking about a mixed bag, or are we talking about pregnant cows that are going to calve?
Well, a comment I can make on that is that generally I and at least several other people that I know of have usually tended to think in terms of cows. Calves aren't necessarily counted except for specific purposes like cow-calf ratios, for instance, to see what the productivity is. Because the calves haven't entered that population yet. So in this sense, we're basically delineating the cows that are having calves, and one of the reasons that we at least did this is a very dynamic thing. What's happening here is something I wanted to point out, and it's another way in which you get a lot of variation in calving, and that is that the animals, if it's a year like many of these years when the animals are flowing into Alaska, the calving period is relatively consistent from year to year, roughly 2.5 weeks long. And the peaks are relatively consistent. So it's relatively consistent in time, but not in space, in the sense that the animals continue to flow across there. And as each cow comes to term, she'll slow down, she'll drop out, she'll go into labor, she'll have a calf within 24 hours to sometimes 48 hours. The calf is capable of keeping up again, and they tend to continue moving on. So as you can see, it's a fairly dynamic thing. And really, these concentrations, at least the ones we did in 72 through 77, you might think of them as snapshots of those animals. They're 1 to 2 day snapshots of those animals. This distribution 2 days later may not have changed markedly, but it changed some. And we try and hit them whenever we could, as much as we could, close to roughly about the peak of calving. But this thing is flowing along all the time. You might look at the next one real quick. This is an example of one thing I might point out here is we're not, and this is from some Canadian data, there may have been a concentration or two present here, we don't know, but primarily what happened this year was this was the first year that came along in which the majority of the animals calved on the Canadian side. And the line that goes into Alaska was relatively small numbers of the herd. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, what happened in 79, a graph you didn't show us, where you showed two separate areas without an interconnection?
Oh, well, that was normally, I don't think I would have done that, but there was a real sort of, it appeared from the data, and those weren't data that we gathered, but what I could gather from the Canadian information, there appeared to be a real hiatus, a blank area in there where there were hardly even scattered animals.
Yeah, but they did their same winter thing and so on. I mean, they're still migratory. But
oh, right. And those things ended up flowing together eventually, too. But
very interesting.
Okay, this is another example in an 82. Fish and Wildlife flying their surveys. Again, the majority of animals apparently calved, probably in the order of 3/4 or more of the herd calved in Canada, and relatively few animals penetrated into Alaska. Some of the things that happened here, I believe this is one year where as the animals basically got into the calving ground area, they were hit by some storm fronts there. One thing I should mention here is even in years when they do calve, on the Canadian side, there's often animals still will enter Alaska with their new calves and continue a westward flow.
I guess that's my question, Dave, is in the years when the core calving area has been used in each one of these, what fraction of the calving females calve in those? I mean, if you've got 180,000 or you got 100,000 cows that are pregnant and they're going to drop, what's the percentages that are in those heavy concentrated areas? Because they calve all the time, don't they?
Actually, I was just coming to that. We have one more. We've got one or two. Another example, just to show differences. Again, this year we had three concentrations. Majority of the animals were in Alaska, fairly well concentrated out and fairly far north this year. This was a year in which animals actually went fairly close out to the Beaufort Coast there, as you can see in the area of the Jacob. Just another quick example. This shows a very large concentration. Actually all years, if you just overlaid all of those concentrations to show over this 15-year period, basically, that 14-year period, the areas that concentrations have occurred in, and you could perhaps draw a line roughly around that shaded area out a little ways, not as far as the green line itself is, but it would basically delineate what I would call the primary calving ground, where over the years the majority of animals have calved. And
yes, you use the term primary calving ground. We've been hearing the term core calving area.
Mm-hmm.
How does that relate?
Okay. I was just going to start commenting on that, but I actually don't like the term core calving area, and in fact, when I did this work, I ended up refraining from using that term because the word core tends to imply a fixed central point. Because of the dynamic situations that you're running into, and particularly this flow westward, let's put up 74 real quick, Mark. What I can point out here is that concentration you see at the west, the shaded area in that particular year, we estimated in something in the order of about 35,000 of the cows were in that area, and it was a fairly dense concentration. But one of the things that's happened in the 1002 report is that only the concentrations have been plotted, and we've lost this part each year of where the majority of animals were, including the concentration. So in this case, the area east of that shaded area contained another roughly 45,000 to 50,000 cows that were calving all along there as they tended to drift westward. So because of the dynamic situation like that, I always, at least what I was attempting to do, was by drawing lines like this, show that there was this area in which much of this was happening, and if there was a concentration for a short time, we'd go ahead and mark it. Some specific comments about the 1002 map. I do have a few problems with it. One of them is, of course, that it only features the concentrations, which sometimes represent, in a given year, about half of the cows. The other half are spread out through some of these larger areas. Basically, the 1002 map, to my mind, emphasizes, of course, the calving that's occurred in and near the 1002 area, but in another way de-emphasizes the calving, and there's been quite a bit of it that's occurred to the east in Alaska and beyond into Canada, and the variation that's occurred there. The map, if you look at that map on the wall, or if you have it in front of you, basically it was constructed by overlaying these concentrations that occurred in that portions of the pregnant cows in the herd. And we didn't take density measurements, but densities were obviously quite variable from year to year. So it shouldn't be taken to mean densities here. Really what that map shows, to my mind, what it's a plot of basically is the frequency of occurrence of those concentrations. And those concentrations consisted of varying proportions of the cows in the herd over the years. Again, also there are somewhat snapshots, and the implication here is that we're coming down to one basically 20 by 20 mile area that's a core, a fixed point, that the animals, the implication is they strive to get to that one point, they're very dependent on it, and it may hold the key to the survival of the population. And at least it's my opinion that I don't agree with that. The animals are much more flexible than that. The caribou don't depend on such a small fixed area, and they're relatively flexible beasts. And I think it's somewhat dangerous to overemphasize such a small area like that at perhaps the expense of the other areas. If the decision is made for development to proceed within the calving grounds, then all areas in it should receive equal attention in terms of taking note of basically doing as much mitigation as you can. And to my mind, the key doesn't rest in that core area. The real key to make these things work, really two keys, is to assure reasonable freedom of movement of the animals. If they have reasonable freedom of movement, that's a real plus. And also another key basically is controlling hunting, whether it be legal or illegal, through controlling access, because that is something that can definitely affect the animals.
Senator Bergkamp.
May I request a copy of the statements that have just been made for the last 5 minutes or so?
We're going to transcribe all of our books.
I would like a copy of that on tape, if I could get it from
yes.
the tape of this testimony. Mr. Chairman, since the chair,
yes.
I think what I heard you say, that the 1002 tends to emphasize the area within, I mean the 1002 report, tends to emphasize the area within 1002 and de-emphasize the areas to the east and other areas they use. Is that
well,
what you said, sir?
Well, it basically that. It tends to emphasize the calving that's occurred in one portion of the calving grounds. In and near the 1002 report, and not quite all of Alaska over to the border, and of course then you have what has happened on the Canadian side over these years. One thing I can add here is that in a majority of years, we've now, this last year I should add, just in 86, the majority of animals again calved in Canada. And again, relating to this frequency of occurrence, a very large contingent of those animals calved in the coastal plain, fairly deep into the Yukon, penetrating several miles into Alaska, and there was a much smaller contingent of those animals that did indeed calve in the core area. But in a lot of the years, the majority of the herd has indeed calved in Alaska, but there's a lot of variation, and again, I have problems with just focusing on that's 20 by 20 miles. And what you can say, something I didn't mention, one thing for sure you can say about that area, though, that should be pointed out, is that it's definitely an area of regular use. And that regular use is by varying proportions. Like this last year, it was a relatively small proportion of during cows in the herd.
But that area of regular use is a wide and diverse area. Is that not so?
Well, what I'm saying is that area that is shaded in pink and red, that's actually relatively small, and even some of the area out around it a bit is tended to be fairly regular use, and part of that has to do with snow conditions. But it's not the area of greatest density.
I noticed it tended to be. This always gets to me. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Judy.
Mr. Chairman, that this is very interesting testimony, and I think we should follow in the subsequent hearings, because basically you're questioning the conclusion reached by the Dow Cameron study, which, or maybe you're not, but anyhow, a great deal of their work, of that work, went into the 1002 report with their extrapolation and the impact area and what would happen when there are concentrations of caribou. You're showing a much larger area, but also you seem to be, if this is your work, drawing some conclusions about what development might do in areas, if there's development, say, in a certain calving area, that they would move away and perhaps fall alternatives, whereas the 1002 report talks about a concentrated area, and even if that's left out, the larger question is not being addressed. Maybe I'm missing something.
Well,
here, but
yeah, I'm not really talking about the Dow Cameron study. I'm showing the variation that has occurred. There's certainly some overlap between the two, and that basically the question is you know, if animals are partially excluded or totally excluded from that core area, you know, what would be the implications of that? And I guess I'm more optimistic than some people. I think the animals are fairly flexible, and that's not the area of greatest concentration, that it is quite variable, and basically I think things aren't quite as dire as some might believe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there could be different conclusions drawn. One could say that impact is going to hit a much larger area, and that, obviously, if you want to open ANWR, that becomes a negative. But what you're saying, that they do disperse, but that they're flexible, are you saying, to development activities that might take place? I think that's got to be the second conclusion in there.
Yes, I think they are fairly flexible to that.
Do we know that?
We don't. Well, you can make inferences. At least what's happened so far, caribou have basically gotten along in the central Arctic herd area. They've continued to increase, that sort of thing. We've also had some other instances. If you look back at some other herds. For instance, a study that I find very interesting done by Davis and Valkenburg looking at the Delta herd. It's an area that's heavily used by the military. They did two interesting analyses. One of them had to do with disturbance, and one had to do with basically things that happened that might affect the core calving area in that case. And there were things like fires that burned near there. Caused smoke in the area. Animals calved, in fact, in one year in the burned area. And the bottom line here is that they basically concluded that the animals appear to be much more flexible in their selection of habitat than people have believed. And that herd is one of the faster growing herds today, in the order of 18 to 20% a year. Even though they've shifted around, they've had a lot of visual and auditory disturbance in that area, and they've had some things happen to the general habitat. They've had wildfires right near the some of the primary calving area, and so on. So from things like this, I at least haven't seen anything yet that given that you don't have just a total access situation where, for instance, hunting may get out of hand, this sort of thing, they seem to get along fairly well. Animals certainly are affected by it. They may be, they obviously are displaced to some degree. Can affect their movements to some degree, things like pipelines and so on. But displacement doesn't necessarily mean that the population is going to suffer.
Senator Jones and Senator Duncan. Pretty well answered both of my questions. Have you seen in your studies of being around it, any indication that large herds would be deterred from moving across the pipeline development or road development? Have you seen any indication?
Well, no, there's not much, of course, there. There isn't anything like that. One thing that is in the range of the porcupine herd now is the Dempster Highway. And, in fact, the animals do cross it. Again, I might emphasize that it appears to be one of the bigger problems of that highway is not the fact that they aren't crossing it or willing to cross it. It has opened up a situation where people who don't normally didn't hunt those animals are now hunting, and it's opened up a situation where people who don't normally didn't hunt those animals are now hunting, and it's increasing the take fairly dramatically in that area, which of course could eventually, you know, if it goes beyond a certain level, lead to a problem. The one thing I can say about, there is a question, there's a definite question on how a large herd would react to certain things. Some of the groups that have been seen in the central Arctic herd that have been deflected are groups of less than 1,000 animals, considered large. Actually, in context of a herd like this, that's not a large group. Large groups are 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 to get these big aggregations out here. And one thing you can say about large groups is that the larger the group, just like the larger the herd, they tend to have, the movements tend to be more forceful. They tend to have a lot more inertia, if you will. And so there's two possibilities here. If you get a group of 50,000 animals moving towards a road, let's say, it may well be that the inertia is a plus, and that the animals may prove to cross such things or handle such things somewhat better than small groups. The converse is also possible in that if they don't, and you get a deflection because of the inertia in those big groups, deflection might prove to be considerably longer. But again, the deflection may not necessarily ultimately affect the population.
Senator Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have actually two questions. Let me ask the first one just so I can get it clear in my mind. I think I missed when you started testifying who you're with and who you did this work for.
I'm with LGL Alaska Research Associates. Previously, I'd worked on the Arctic Gas Project through 72 through 77. That's when I did that work on the herd, and basically asked to come here to talk about this variation by Standard Alaska Production on AOGA.
You did do this work in this report? Or you did do this work in this report?
I provided some comments in there. Right.
The other question that I had is, I think this has gotten more confusing for me today than it was yesterday. Yesterday, I was almost convinced by Fish and Wildlife Service and Fish and Game that a core calving area, and that's what we had to worry about. Today, you've convinced me that we don't have a core calving area, that there's a much larger area that we have to be concerned with. And but do you want to respond to that, or I was going to ask you further?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that I think the problem here is that you can call it a primary calving ground if you want. You can call it a core calving area. But I think the difficulty is in considering a core calving area that the herd is hinged on that's as small as shown here. That core area or primary area is really quite a bit larger than that, at least the way I would define it.
Well, let me ask you, let's just take the 1985 concentrated calving area as an example. Which, maybe that's not a good example, but you just might want to use it. Do we know that if there was something going on in that area, some exploration or some development, et cetera, that those caribou would calve elsewhere, they would stop short of that calve, or are there weather conditions and other conditions that would...
That's something that actually we don't know. If there was, let's say there's development going on in that area, that large concentration, there would undoubtedly be some displacement. It's hard to say from year to year whether those animals are going to, in which area they're going to calve. But if they were to go in there, there would undoubtedly be, you know, some displacement, but it may not ultimately affect the animals. They may indeed calve short of there.
Well, they've calved numerous other places.
Pardon?
They have calved over these 10 years numerous other places, right? Could we assume that if they were forced out of that area that they would go to some other area to calve, or are there other conditions?
They probably would. And ultimately, if conditions were really rough in those particular areas that they got into, let's say very deep snow, then you could, of course, start to lose some calves and so on. But basically, it's not often that you have just one playset
point. And we think that it's very important that, this get on the record. And I have a full menu this morning, and I've got several questions, too, but I think that we have Mr. Height that has to leave, and so could we impose upon you to come down Anchorage on Saturday? We'll, if it's necessary, we'll pay the way to get down there. So why don't we, Senator Jones, if you had a parting word, why
I just did.
It's obvious on your last chart here in this book that how the Melanie Point, how they're calving right close to that. But we'll get into that next week. And I thank you very much, Dave. We must go on. Dave Height, you want to come with us, and we'll get your presentation, and we'll start to see if we can get up here. Carry it.
Alaska AFL-CIO and Teamsters Local 959 announced a joint position regarding ANWR on December 1st of 1986. Our support for the development of ANWR requires certain guarantees. Our position has not changed. First, the oil extraction industry must cease the deliberate displacement of Alaskans with out-of-state workers for the purpose of undercutting Alaskan wage standards and denying Alaskans the right to union representation. Second, a fair prevailing wage must be established by the state of Alaska for all classifications of workers employed in the region before the oil extraction industry is allowed to develop ANWR. Third, appropriate environmental safeguards must be provided for. We are not unmindful of other considerations, such as preserving our 90-10 split with the federal government and not the 50-50 giveaway some would suggest. Indeed, our own state government has failed us miserably in their stewardship of our non-renewable oil wealth from Prudhoe Bay and associated fields, failed to establish and maintain proper tariffs, severance, and corporate taxes, failed to collect revenues due under existing laws, and finally has failed to pass Alaskan employment preference legislation for natural resource projects. Increasingly, those voters I represent are telling myself and other labor leaders that if I can't get work there, if we can't get our share, then tell them to leave the oil in the ground. We will not join those who would plunge headlong into a develop-at-any-cost mentality. We do not believe that the citizens of Alaska will benefit by osmosis, and we will not maintain our present support forever.
About the development of ANWR and some kind of a statement, and trying to pull together all of the diverse interests. What do you have to have, you as organized labor, have to see in order to say, okay, we're going to go back there and we're going to give you a hand. We're going to work with the national unions and we're going to go for this.
We're going to have to see written guarantees, Senator. We're going to have to see some changes to the state, the oil companies. Right now, and that was part of my thrust, why should we believe that we will see problems, that it will be better, problems will be changed in ANWR, while abuses are ongoing in Prudhoe Bay, even as we speak?
Mr. Chairman, just to follow that up, what mechanisms are you pursuing, Barry, on behalf of organized labor, to see that your concerns are met?
We're, well, you know,
you're talking to us right now, for one.
You've seen me items I've listed here. I think it's well known to everyone that we're ready to sit down and talk with the oil companies. The appropriate labor people who lead those who work up north made themselves available. I have to say that I have seen or heard of no sign at this point that encourages us to believe it will be any different.
Turn them off.
My own mic.
the basis for this 2 mile exclusion is. And it was a study by Down Cameron in the Milne Point area. And they did a study of the distribution of calving caribou in a period where there was 4 years before the road was constructed and 4 years after the road was constructed. And we believe that Fish and Wildlife Service then misinterpreted or misapplied information from that report. At this point, I can refer you to the graphs that you've got in front of you and point out that on these graphs, you can see that there is a dashed line and some open circles. The open circles represent, well, start back looking at the axes. The bottom axis is the distance from the road. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 6 kilometers. The other axis is the density of caribou. It's a little confusing because it's the density of caribou raised to the 1/2 power, which means the square root of the density. I'll explain into that in just a few moments, but first of all, the open circles represent the data points, which is a 4-year means for the period before the road was constructed. And on the basis of those, that data, the dashed line was calculated. The solid circles are the data points that were collected after the road was constructed. And the solid line then is a line calculated to fit those points. First point is that, indeed, the biologist who did the study plotted the density of calving caribou before and after the road was constructed, as we see here. One of the problems that we have in interpreting this is that only the 4-year means were shown, so it's hard to appreciate what the annual variability is. So there are other, four other dots representing those data, which we can't see from this figure. They then used, transformed the data using square roots. And this is a perfectly proper procedure that has, there's statistical reasons why that's a perfectly proper thing to do. The one thing that is, though, that for most of us is just confusing because we're used to looking at the real numbers and not looking at square roots. Because you can see the open circles, which represent the numbers of calving caribou before the road was built show an increase away from the future roadway and then a decline again. And this increase followed by a decline, from that increase followed by a decline, you then can calculate a line, and it turns out that line looks like a straight line. It gives the impression that there was an even density of caribou through this area before the road was built. In fact, you can see that if you look at the dots, you can see there's a variability in that. And if you also look at some of these values down here, in fact, they suggest that this line doesn't represent that information very well. After the road is built then, you can see that after road construction, you can see that there's an increasing density the further away from the road that one goes. Some of the questions that are left open in the study are the effects of weather conditions, snow conditions, how those might also affect the distribution, and that's unanswered at this point. It's important to note that the authors of the report itself did not claim that the animals were excluded from an area near the road. They simply showed what they thought was a decline in the frequency of animals near the road, but not exclusion. What the analysts at Fish and Wildlife Service did was to take the point at which these two lines cross to make an interpretation on the three things that I think strike me about this information. First is that the dash line before the road was built and the solid line after the road was built show basically the same trend. Even before the roadway was there, there was a tendency for caribou to occur in that area in lower densities and then away from the future roadway. Now, as Dr. Reglin mentioned yesterday, there was a meeting between industry biologists and fish and game biologists, and we looked and did some analysis of the data that wasn't included in the original report, and it turns out that there is a statistically significant difference in this interval from 0 to 1 kilometers. These two points are in fact statistically different. There is statistical difference also out to 2 kilometers. Beyond that, though, beyond 2 kilometers, out to 5 kilometers, these points statistically are not different from one another. We again get statistical difference out at the far end of these lines, where the densities were much higher after the road was built. Pardon me, I'm going to end up repeating myself here just a little bit. Okay, but that is just what we said here. One of the other points is that the density of caribou out to 6 kilometers after the road was built was 2 times the density before the road was built. And that reflects at least in part the fact that the herd was growing at a very rapid rate through this 8-year period that the study was done. The points that we wish to make are, first of all, that there is no 2-mile exclusion zone. Indeed, within 2 kilometers, which is about 1.2 miles, there is an apparent decrease in the number of caribou during the period between the periods before and after the road was built. There still are some unanswered questions, I think, about what influence differences in weather conditions might have had during that period as well. But it doesn't surprise me or most other biologists to think that the caribou may, in fact, tend to avoid the immediate vicinity of roads and other kinds of facilities. So this isn't surprising, but it does not constitute 2 miles of exclusion. The other point is that this small amount of displacement has not been shown in any way to have been harmful to the caribou. And indeed, during that entire period, the Central Arctic herd was growing rapidly and were calving not only near this area, but also in the Kuparik oil field area. And a final point is that it's entirely possible if development happens within the calving areas in the 10-02 area, that during the period when calving animals are present, that activities can be reduced and disturbance therefore minimized.
Senator Jones.
Mark, is the road planned? Is this good there to accident, or was the plan? It looks like the plan because it's put in an area where there's a lower density of animals and stuff, lower use.
I believe the road was planned independent of that distribution of caribou, and the study then was planned to cover the four-year period before the road was built, as well as the four-year period after the road was built. It just happened that it was in an area that where the density of caribou happened to be lower even before the road was in place.
Okay, you might want to come back to the table and get that fan off. Maybe we can hear him. Mark, just a couple quick questions. On your sheet, you also said that you were going to just give us a little bit of testimony on the bowhead whales. And my question basically is that I'm really concerned about the impact of the single bottom oil tankers going from the Canadian side going across our waters during the migration of the bowhead whale, and what steps do oil companies, or what steps can we take, what steps can the state take, what steps can the federal government take to minimize that risk? That open up a whole another chapter?
It is a whole different aspect of things. Concerns about potential disturbance to bowhead whales from large traffic that's may occur from the production of the Mollagac well in Canada. We don't have a lot of detail at this point as to precisely what that project will comprise. I think it's probably concerned about interference, perhaps, with subsistence whaling. Indeed, I went to a great deal of effort, as did the whalers, to come to a working agreement last year that worked very successfully for both parties, to be able to cooperate, communicate, so that our industry could share the ocean at the same time with the native whalers. And an important part of development of Beaufort Sea, Canadian Beaufort Sea oil, and its transportation north of Alaska would be to try to develop a similar means so that subsistence whaling for bowheads.
I wanted to get that on record. Anybody, do you have any questions? Thank you very much, Mark. We'll see you in Anchorage. Rick Davidge.
About national security implications of the question of opening ANWR to oil and gas development or closing it to wilderness. Why is that of concern before this committee? Unfortunately, as an Alaskan, the issue will be decided not by Alaskans, but by members of the United States Congress, and we only have three in Washington, D.C. It clearly is issue of national importance, whether or not this energy resource will be open. Probably the easiest way to step away from discussions of caribou and bowhead whales and the immediate economic impact in Alaska is to talk or quote directly from a letter from the Secretary of Energy to the President last year, which focused on the growing concerns from an economic standpoint and also a national security standpoint with the trends in oil and gas in our country. If I may, the positive trends of 1981 to 85 towards reduced U.S. dependence on imported oil, particularly from the Middle East, are being reversed. Imports from the Middle East more than doubled during the first 7 months of 1986 and have since doubled since then. Recent oil price decline has resulted significant reductions in U.S. exploration, production, and drilling activity. And clearly, these reductions run quickly in reverse, quickly meaning 3 to 5 years. Lower oil prices are encouraging the growth in energy demand, not only within the United States, but across the Western world. And finally, a recent report to the President concludes that until oil price increases, oil vulnerability to oil price shocks, possible oil shortages, where stoppages will rise to an excessively dangerous level. All of this could seriously affect our strategic and national security, as well as our economic stability. Last year, in an article, I predicted that in 3 to 5 years, America will be standing in line again. Prediction, I hope, doesn't come true. But I have become aware of a series of studies, not only by our national government, but other consulting firms and other nations that are looking at the trends in energy consumption and exploration and development across the world. In the article, I pointed out that it is not an optional question, but in fact, the numbers are simply there and predict that America will be standing in line again. Increasing consumption of energy resources by our nation and Western nations across the world is a direct reflection of the lower price of oil and gas, and is rather unbelievable in the face of all that we learned in 79 and in the late 60s. You all know about the decreasing inflation of production. If you talk to Louisiana or Texas or California or some of the other states, they are real aware of it as well. Obviously, we are raising our dependence on domestic imports from increasingly unstable Middle East countries. But one other thing is going to happen at the same time as this trend line comes to a crisis. That's America will elect a new president. What does that have to do with anything? One of the interesting concerns of the National Security Agency and the Pentagon, as a new president comes into office, is that within the first 18 months of that presidency, the enemies of America find it an appropriate time to test the mettle or the resolve of our new president. It's predictable. It happens. You can go back through history and read. Within 3 to 18 months, Soviet Union or other unfriendly powers decide in some manner to test the resolve of a new president. I don't know who that new president is going to be, at least not yet. And given the trend lines with respect to energy, with respect to the increasing control that the Soviet Union has, it is the largest oil and gas producer in the world. Most people think it's the Middle East, but it is the Soviet Union. Kuwait and Saudi Arabia come second. We put ourselves in a very difficult national security problem. It immediately changes with our growing economic and strategic dependence on oil and gas resources in the Middle East. It immediately changes our strategic, military, and our diplomatic policies. Something called the Delta Force, which most of you are aware of, was in fact created by the President and Congress and deployed in these strategic areas in the Middle East to be ready in the event of an international crisis to ensure the supplies of those resources. And again, as our dependence upon those resources rises, our vulnerability at each of those strategic points rises. We all know the economic shocks that took place in the late 60s and late 70s as a result of the embargo and increased price. The facts are clear that the United States and the Western world are more dependent now, and significantly more dependent, to a much deeper level, on petroleum resources than ever before. Not just in gas in our automobiles, but across the board in manufacturing. High technology is extremely dependent on oil and gas resources. I'm going to skip over a few things. One of the things that that I have in my perspective on this issue is something called time. The decision to open ANWR now gives the people of Alaska and the United States, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the time to go in, to plan, to do the EIS processes, and to develop and explore the petroleum resources of ANWR in a rational and reasonable manner. I predict that if we don't make that decision soon, and we find ourselves into the next Congress or the Congress after that, that the time factor will disappear. We'll be in a crisis mode and have immediate direction either by government drilling, which I would not mechanism to go in, to get it up, to get that online, and get, make it available. No question that the oil embargo made a big impact on the decision of Congress with respect to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. I'd like to just read a couple of short quotes from the report, which I've got some executive summaries to, and I'll be providing you copies of in Anchorage, that might highlight a couple of the concerns. Military national security implications of increased U.S. reliance on oil imports. This is from an interim report from the Secretary of Energy to the President. U.S. military presence seeks to prevent the dominance of strategic oil exporting regions by governments hostile to the United States and aid friendly regions in the defense of their oil fields and distribution systems. I would underline friendly regimes are not necessarily as friendly as some other allies of the United States. Rising U.S. petroleum imports, as well as increased oil imports by our allies, would increase U.S. strategic interest in the Mideast, which holds about 63% cumulatively of the free world's oil reserves. The greater such interest, the more likely is a commitment of military resources to the region in order to maintain access to oil imports. Such a commitment either increases total demands for military capabilities or diverts U.S. defense capabilities from elsewhere in the world, and is in either case a direct cost of dependence on Mideast oil. By strengthening the financial conditions of individual OPEC nations, and specifically some very unfriendly nations, high U.S. oil imports would enhance the ability of these nations to use oil as a weapon to gain political and economic ends. I said the Soviet Union is the world's largest oil and natural gas producer, holds enormous, proven, known oil and gas reserves, as is second only to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. A $10 increase in the world price of oil would increase Soviet hard currency earnings rather dramatically by over $6 billion per year at a present value, and possibly by much more in the future at present dollar value. Finally, the expansion of domestic oil production has several advantages. ANWR is clearly the best chance we have in North America. One, higher U.S. oil production will exert downward pressure on the world price of oil. Two, when increased domestic oil production reduces the chances of a supply disruption that would have a sharp impact on world oil prices, since less U.S. demand for oil imports will increase lack world oil markets. Three, should there be a serious event that disrupts supply, and I think we've seen a few of those in the last few years, the cost of the U.S. economy will be reduced if U.S. oil import demand is less relative to its total oil supply. And four, less U.S. dependence on oil, on foreign oil, allows foreign policy to be more flexible and strengthens relationships with oil importing allies. In conclusion, I provided you a copy of